You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Magical Thinking by Silvana Paternostro. The brothers have been criticized in some quarters for allowing the Netflix adaptation and for the recent publication of Until August, an unfinished novel that Gabo, already suffering from advanced dementia, had ordered to be destroyed. The book has had mixed reviews, mostly glowing and respectful in Colombia, terrible in the United States. When I read that we were being greedy, I feel sad for a few minutes, but ultimately these are the decisions we have to make, says Garcia Barca. In 2018, Ramos, who had just been appointed to his new post at Netflix, was ready to take the streamer's Latin American offerings to another level. Netflix's philosophy of going local had already proven effective worldwide. The Crown is British. Squid Game is South Korean. Money Heist is Spanish. The House of Flowers is Mexican. It was time to replicate this formula in South American countries. Narcos takes place in Colombia and Mexico, but it's a Netflix U.S. production. The idea of adapting 100 years started to float around in corporate meetings, and it stuck. Ramos ran with it. But first he had to negotiate with Mercedes, who was still part of the estate's decision-making at the time. Gabo's family demanded that the series be as long as the story required, that it be in Spanish, and that it be filmed in Colombia. Gabo's sons came on board as executive producers. Next photos, It Takes a Village. Jose Arcadio Buendia and Ursula Iglaran's nuptials, and fur traffickers crossed the desert on their way to Macondo. Macondo was built near Ibagué, a town in the Andes. It's far from the Caribbean, but it has a similar mountainous topography to the area around Arcataca, where the foothills of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta cascade into the sea. Eugenio Caballero, Pan's Labyrinth, and Barbara Enriquez, Roma, have designed the sets, so Macondo in the Andes promises to be gorgeous. On set, as in the novel, Macondo transforms from a settlement of straw-roofed huts for 20 families into a full-blown town. It's all been built on human scale. You can walk around the Buendia house, the pharmacy, the bar, and the market. Some of Gabo's most ardent fans will be wary of seeing characters that have lived in their imaginations for the last six decades. I don't want Netflix to tell me what Colonel Aureliano Buendia looks like, says Colombian-born Gustavo Arango, a professor of literature and author of two books about Garcia Marquez. I've always imagined he looks like my grandfather, as every Colombian has. But when I'm shown some early footage in Bogota, I enjoy seeing those faces in locations that, to me, seem out of a biblical Colombia. I recognize the arrival of Melquiades, the gypsy who disturbs the idyllic hamlet when he appears with his impressive magnet and his magnifying glass, and the advent of Rebecca, the child that eats earth with her hands. I enjoy the anger with which the Buendia patriarch receives the government official who comes to his front door, thinking he can tell the people of Macondo what to do. The costumes are elaborate, every detail perfectly curated. The actors all have amazing faces. There are no stars in the production, although many are respected local actors, including Claudio Cattaneo as Colonel Aureliano Buendia, Marleida Soto as the older Ursula Iglaran, and Diego Vasquez as the older Jose Arcadio Buendia. The non-actors prepared by attending theater workshops. Like the novel, the 100 Years series is sparing with dialogue. It's certainly not Succession, says Alex Garcia Lopez, the principal director, on a video call from Barcelona. Some of the one-liners I hear are memorable, however. When Ursula Iguaran gives birth to her first child, he is born with women's buttocks. Garcia Lopez, who tells me that the series won't be like the phantasmagorical Harry Potter, when a ghost shows up and there's a halo and the music goes up, that answers the magical realism question. Netflix isn't interested in flashy and expensive special effects. The directing is split between two Latin Americans. Garcia Lopez was born in Argentina and has ample experience working on big American productions, including a few Marvel series. The other director is Colombian-born writer-director Lara Mora, who has a long-standing relationship with Netflix and whose films The Kings of the World and Killing Jesus have earned festival acclaim. The director's styles couldn't be more different. Garcia Lopez is vertiginous. I wanted a lot of movement. I wanted to capture the chaos, where Mora is contemplative. I'm a cinema purist. Garcia Lopez shoots from above, Mora from a more intimate perspective. Garcia Lopez mentions Kusturica and Terrence Malick. Mora references Fellini and Lucrecia Martel. I think they chose us because we are so different, says Mora on a video call from her native Medellin, and because we are a good complement. They also reflect the two different histories within the novel. 100 Years offers a metaphorical history of civilization in the largest sense, as well as the more specific story of Colombia and the Caribbean. The book never actually mentions dates, and it plays with time. This adaptation, conceived by Jose Rivera, the Oscar-nominated screenwriter of The Motorcycle Diaries, is linear and closely pegged to what happened in Colombia between 1850 and 1950. Garcia Lopez, perhaps because he is not Colombian, sees the universal message about the failure of societies. Mora highlights the tragedy of Colombia and the country's inability to find a way to live together after a century of violence. Both directors are quick to point out that their adaptation will be as demanding as the novel. It is not light entertainment, says Mora, who compares it to the tone and scope of Killers of the Flower Moon. It deals with big, strong themes, a complex universe. Filming the series, particularly in Colombia, has meant doing justice to a work of art held up as a symbol of patriotic pride. Vasquez, who plays the older José Arcadio Buendía, gets so moved at times that he cries on set. He can't believe that life has given him the opportunity to play such an emblematic character, even though he spends much of his time tied to a tree. During production in Colombia, Garcia Lopez says he continually heard, "This is so important to us. This story is so Colombian." I would go, yes, but once a book sells 50 million copies worldwide, it becomes a global phenomenon. It doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to humanity. It is 4 p.m, and the Caribbean sun is easing when I meet Gabriel Eligio Torres Garcia, Gabo's nephew, in the Parque de Bolívar, one of Colonial Cartagena's main squares. Gabo Gabo, as he is known, gives walking tours of the spots where his uncle used to hang out. He integrates both fictional characters and real places that Gabo mentions in his novels, especially Love in the Time of Cholera, which is mostly set in a city inspired by this walled port. Gabo Gabo, a nickname given to him by his famous uncle to distinguish him from the other three Gabriels in his family, greets me with typical Caribbean warmth, as if we have known each other all our lives. He points to the park bench where he was sitting and tells me Gabo spent his first night in Cartagena right there. It was 1948. He had dropped out of law school in Bogota, deciding that he would rebel against his parents' expectations and dedicate his life to writing. He didn't go home to where his parents lived, because he knew his mother would be able to figure it out just by looking at him. He lied and said he would enroll in Cartagena's law school and convinced a relative to bring him the money he needed for a room. In the meantime, Gabo Gabo says, he would wait and sleep here until two cops came by, smoked all his cigarettes, and took him to the police precinct. Thanks to a recommendation from a friend, Gabo was hired to write editorials at El Universal. My guide tells me, as we pass the dilapidated building that used to house the newspaper. At 21, Gabo walked through the arches known as the Clock Tower and realized that Cartagena would become his home in the Caribbean. Gabo Gabo quotes his uncle's memoir, Living to Tell the Tale. I could not repress the feeling of having been born again. In his late 60s, Gabo bought an old yarn factory that faced the sea and hired Rogelio Salmona, Colombia's premier architect, to build his red-bricked palazzo. It was where he came to smell the guavas, the metaphor he used for his yearning for the tropics. Cartagena and its colonial history and architecture, the fortress that kept the pirates at bay, is as storied and beautiful as the Caribbean gets. It was also the place where his parents and most of his siblings had ended up and would religiously gather for New Year's. Gabo loved walking the streets and getting recognized if he needed a bath of fame, which he sometimes did. Gabo Gabo sprinkles his stories with indiscreet family details. He tells me that he inherited the role of teller of family lore after his uncle Jaime, Gabo's brother, succumbed to dementia. We live with the blessing of our storytelling ability and with the curse of memory loss, Gabo Gabo says. My uncle wrote about the plague of forgetfulness in 100 years of solitude, and here we are 50 years later, a premonition come true. Gabo Gabo's own mother, Rita's illness, is so advanced that she doesn't recognize her son. The sunset hour is approaching as we walk toward Gabo's house. It is clear from Gabo Gabo's stories how much Gabo drew his stories and characters from real-life incidents and people. Gabo Gabo's sister Margot not only ate earth like Rebecca, but was as spiteful as Amaranta, both characters in 100 years. The character of Candida Arendera, the poor girl who is paraded and prostituted by her grandmother across the desert in the short story that bears her name, is based on a housemaid that serviced all his uncles, including Gabo. I blanch at some of these intimate details. Did Gabo oppose the telling of such indiscretions, I ask? According to Gabo Gabo, the great writer's advice was quite direct. Just make sure you charge money for them. The family skill at storytelling, Gabo Gabo tells me, stemmed from a long-standing tradition during which everybody would sit around and tell and retell the history of their immediate family and its ancestors. I can identify each one of my aunts and uncles in 100 years of solitude, he says. His grandmother was unimpressed by how Gabo, who usually only listened during those storytelling sessions, recycled real-life family tales in his fiction. She always said that she preferred her daughter, Aida Rosa, who was a nun, to her son, who was a Nobel Prize winner. Gabo Gabo points at a white balconied colonial mansion. That was the inspiration for Fermina Daza's house in Love in the Time of Cholera, he says. He asked me if I remember how her husband, Dr. Urbino, died. Yes, he fell from a ladder trying to grab a parrot, I say. That is exactly how Gabo's grandfather died, he tells me. So my uncle took that detail, something that happened when he was 8 years old, and boom, he grabbed it when he needed it. After the tour, we stopped by to see Jaime Abello, who runs the Gabo Foundation, an organization that Garcia Marquez started in 1995 to promote independent journalism, and that has become also an important guardian of Gabo's legacy. We find Abello sitting at his desk, a portrait of Gabo behind him. He is excited to show us his latest project, a 650-page book written by Juan Valentin Fernandez, a Spanish doctor who spent a decade tracing all the medical details and real-life doctors that Garcia Marquez mentioned in his fiction. Look at how exhaustive Gabo was, Abello says, showing me the manuscript. Everything is based in reality. He turns to Gabo Gabo. Do you remember the questionnaires? Garcia Marquez's closest siblings, friends, and associates would receive pages of questions. Abello got one when Gabo was working on the section in his memoirs about his time in Barranquilla. He not only wanted to know the name of the brothels, he wanted to know the size of the rooms. Abello then grabs another book published by the foundation, titled Gabo, Journalist, a chronology of his life as a reporter, and a collection of his quotes about the profession. He opens the book and asks me to read one. My books are a journalist books, even if not many people see them as such. But these books involve a ton of research, checking of data, historical strictness, and dedication to the facts, which in essence makes them fictionalized or fantasized works of reportage. The methods of research and handling of data are those of a journalist. Abello closes the book with determination. The real magic is Gabo's writing. The posthumous publication of Gabo's last novel, combined with the promise of the Netflix series, has sparked Gabomania in Colombia. Everyone who is anyone has written a newspaper column, recorded a podcast, or posted a photograph taken with the great man on social media. The government has organized a Macondo route, hoping that just as the fans of Game of Thrones visit Croatia to see where the series was filmed, fans of Gabo's writing will come to Colombia to see the locations from 100 years. In Barranquilla, Gabo readers can now stay in room 204 of a present-day hotel that claims it was the boarding house where he once wrote and borrowed soap. The Colombian writer Carolina Sanin takes issue with all this off-the-cuff storytelling that takes over her country. She even refuses to call the novelist Gabo. He deserves better than the picturesque approach, she insists. Garcia Marquez wrote an epic about the birth and rebirth of civilization, written from the other side of the world. He is Latin America's Homer, she tells me, as we sit in a coffee shop in Bogota, where she grew up. He was fully aware of the magnitude of that book. It was an illumination that defined the difference between the old world and the new world, and why we are different. When Until August came out in March, its selling point was that the protagonist was a modern woman who dared to explore her sexuality outside of her marriage. I find it endearing to see Garcia Marquez taking this risk. It speaks of his resilience and discipline that got him to finish his novels, against all odds in his 20s and against all odds in his 80s, with the Damocles sword of dementia dangling over him. But a younger generation of women bristles at the marketing of the novella. Honestly, says Nadia Salias, a Colombian-born writer and professor at Bowdoin College, who specializes in feminist readings of the Caribbean, women readers today don't need someone akin to a grandfather dictating our path to freedom, sexual or otherwise. Salias can also be critical of her literary hero. That I criticize his portrayal of the women does not mean I don't admire the author or that I dismiss the importance of his work, she says. In 100 years, Remedios Moscote is 9 years old when she is spotted by her Buendia suitor, is married right after her first menstruation, and dies right before giving birth to twins. In Love in the Time of Cholera, Florentino Ariza takes a 12-year-old girl as his lover while he waits for Fermina, the love of his life, to give in to him. When she finally does, he abandons her. America Vicuña, at 14, kills herself. When I realized that I had read and loved that book as a teenager, says Salias, and had not seen the abuse of America Vicuña, I sobbed. Later, Salias leaves a message on my phone. 100 years of solitude is a warning about our capacity for self-destruction, particularly brought on by men, she says with professorial confidence. It is a manual of patriarchy. Garcia Marquez could see the destruction caused by greed and power. Sadly, he overlooked the complicity of men when it came to their domination of women. Gabo's and Mercedes' ashes are interred in the courtyard of the Mercy Convent in Cartagena. A bust of a smiling and mustachioed Gabo watches over it. Their resting place, surrounded by bushes with tiny pink flowers, is tended by a gardener who seems as interested in chatting up visitors as he is in looking after the plants. He heard that Gabo never actually wrote his books. In fact, he tells me with a wink of complicity, they were all written by a peasant who would slip the Nobel laureate the complete pages. All Gabo had to do was take them to a publisher. A Mexican tourist, holding a copy of one of Gabo's books, interrupts. He wants a picture in front of the memorial. I love Gabo, he offers wholeheartedly. A security guard joins us. Some people come and kneel in front of him, he says. Yes, but he didn't write the books, the gardener insists. The guard points to the second floor of the cloister, where he says Mercedes' ghost appears at noon on her way to microwave her lunch. He also tells of the cloister's cat that went feral when her ashes arrived. It is a complicated story, somehow related to the news that in 1990 Gabo fathered a daughter out of wedlock. I can't help but wonder at all the things that Gabo left behind, all the stories in the air. Who will keep it all? I wonder aloud. The guard's answer could not be simpler, more poetic, or more in keeping with Garcia Marquez's style. The living. Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Who? Disney is on the hunt for a new CEO to replace the legendary Bob Iger when he retires again at the end of 2026. Inside a $200 billion kingdom looking for a new king, or for the first time ever, a queen, by Natalie Jarvie and Joy Press. Opening photo of mice and man. Walt Disney, photographed by Edward Steichen for Vanity Fair in 1933, with that famous mouse in the background. Last October, Bob Iger donned shades and a ceremonial black robe to help choose the finalist for the Disney Employees Halloween Costume Contest. It was a warm day on the studio lot in Burbank, California, and the CEO's top lieutenants joined him to help with the judging. A George Lucas look-alike paraded by, which made Iger smile, then a Mary, Mary Poppins. But it had been a painful year at the Magic Kingdom, and the group representing Disneyland's Haunted Mansion tilted a little dark. One of them hoisted a sign with a hatchet, dripping blood, a picture of Iger, altered so he was smiling like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and the words, "I'm back, 4 days a week, baby." The hatchet was presumably a symbol for cuts and layoffs. The creepy prose, a reference to Iger's unpopular return-to-work policy. "The vibe has been tough," one Disney employee told us earlier last year. "They really put us through the ringer." In November 2022, Iger made a surprise return to Disney following a much-heralded and very brief retirement to clean up the messes created by his hand-picked successor, Bob Chapek, and deal with a radically altered entertainment landscape. Within a year, he eliminated 8,000 positions as part of a $7.5 billion cost-cutting plan. Several of the company's recent sequels, live-action remakes, and IP efforts had disappointed at the box office. Wall Street was pressuring him to make Disney Plus profitable. The debilitating actors and writer strikes were underway, and billionaire activist investor Nelson Peltz was threatening an assault on the Magic Kingdom. The CEO's latest contract is set to expire at the end of 2026, after he turns 75, and some of the lieutenants who helped him judge the costume contest are now in the running to be America's next top Iger. Iger has always been clear. He loves running Disney, but if he was reluctant to retire in the past, he doesn't appear to be now. By many accounts, the succession question is now a top priority as he and the Disney board narrow in on a handful of internal candidates and consider potential external candidates. The board essentially rubber-stamped Iger's last choice. It won't this time. Bob Chapek may be the biggest mistake Bob Iger made in his career, says Bank of America analyst Jessica Reif Ehrlich. A source with close ties to Disney puts it more colorfully. The board royally effed up last time. Disney's board is now stacked with executives who handled their own smooth handoffs. A source familiar with the process says the company won't make a decision this year. Ideally, it will in 2025, so Iger can bring the CEO in waiting up to speed and show them Disney's version of the nuclear codes. It's said that there are now four key internal candidates who have to figure out how to lobby for the job without looking like they're lobbying for the job. Disney Entertainment co-chairman Dana Walden and Alan Bergman, E-SPAN chairman Jimmy Pitaro, and Disney Experiences chairman Josh D'Amaro. There's also a massive Disney workforce treading on the tippiest of toes. "People don't know which horse to bet on," says the source with close ties. "They're afraid to cross anybody." Anyone who thinks succession was entirely about the Murdochs hasn't spent much time studying Disney. Michael Eisner, who preceded Iger as CEO, left the company after a shareholder revolt. Eisner was a charming but capricious executive who hadn't always been convinced Iger was ideal for the job. Iger had joined Disney in 1996, following its acquisition of Capital Cities ABC, having worked his way up from weatherman at a small cable station to top TV exec. Here's the With Friends Like These memo Eisner wrote confidants on the board about Iger when he was mulling a potential replacement years before his departure. He is not an enlightened or brilliantly creative man, but with a strong board, he absolutely could do the job. Once Iger had the gig, he also found it hard to relinquish. After extending his contract several times, he set up a bake-off between two of his top lieutenants with an eye toward succession. Later, Iger reportedly lost confidence in the winning baker, who quickly left the company. Iger's contract was extended again in 2017. "I'm serious about it this time," he told an audience, meaning his retirement as CEO. Later that year, Disney announced a deal ultimately worth more than $70 billion to acquire the lion's share of 21st Century Fox's film and TV assets and re-upped his contract again. Though he finally stepped down as CEO in 2020, he didn't even truly retire, instead becoming executive chairman for another 22 months. Chapek took over right in time for the devastating pandemic, and his relationship with Iger reportedly disintegrated. He didn't last 3 years in the role. After Iger returned as CEO, the board tacked an extra 2 years onto his new contract to give him enough time to get succession right. Disney is the second biggest entertainment company in the world after Netflix. It's worth more than $200 billion and has swallowed, among other things, Lucasfilm, Marvel, and most of Fox. It operates more like a small country, population 225,000, than your average entertainment conglomerate. Many of its workers, or cast members, as they are earnestly called in the Parks Division, are loyal to the company in a way that borders on nationalism. Who could possibly oversee it all? One Disney employee characterizes the race as an open ball game, but most Hollywood insiders believe that it's Walden's job to lose. "The word about succession is that it's all Dana all the time," says a top agent. Walden, 59, is a longtime TV executive with a Svengali-like ability to woo talent. She also has a close relationship with Iger, her neighbor in Tony Brentwood, where they regularly stroll among the mansions. Walden's three-decade-long career in television likely reminds Iger of his own path to the top, even if that means she might have blind spots when it comes to the theme parks or the Eastman business. A former Disney executive who worked closely with Walden says, "I think she could be great, but it's not going to be a slam dunk." Others, meanwhile, are convinced that DeMauro, 53, will take the throne. When he travels to the theme parks, people line up to meet him. In a chart, Bob's your uncle. Sources say one of four key Disney executives, pictured here, will likely replace Bob Iger as CEO. Here's the cast of characters. Bob Iger, CEO, an iconic leader who oversaw some of Disney's most prosperous years. His hand-picked replacement was ousted by the board in fairly short order, so Iger unretired to right the ship. Dana Walden, co-chairman, entertainment, a savvy TV executive who's a force in Hollywood and has helped steward shows as different as 24, Modern Family, Glee, and Abbott Elementary. She's close to Iger, and they've had similar trajectories. Alan Bergman, co-chairman, entertainment, runs Disney's sprawling and lately beleaguered film business. He's a former finance exec, but he's been studying up on the creative side. James Cameron likes him, a rare badge of honor for a studio chief. Josh DeMauro, chairman, experiences, the park's chief, received a serious vote of confidence recently when the company doubled its investment in his fiefdom to roughly $60 billion. DeMauro, who is treated like a celebrity when he walks through Disneyland, is said to have inspired an Iger-like cult of personality. Jimmy Pitaro, chairman, E-SPAN, a down-to-earth guy running a declining cable business that's making enormous bets this year. Pitaro has worked in more corners of Disney than his peers. He's based in Connecticut, but has worked for Iger for years and is said to have a deft touch with talent. Tall and silver-haired, DeMauro is the executive who seems most built in Iger's mold, able to charm hourly workers and visiting dignitaries in equal measure. In Hollywood, however, he's a relative unknown. Josh has a very Iger-like cult of personality, says another former Disney executive. Does he understand how to operate a media business, though? Especially a media business that is dealing with the onset of AI and all these other threats to the business. I don't know. Pitaro, 54, and Bergman, 58, are less obvious choices for CEO, though there's still time. The former is well-liked and has a background running Disney Interactive that gives him perspective on how to position Disney for a streaming future. But he's got his hands full launching the flagship E-SPAN streaming service and a sports streaming joint venture. As for Bergman, he's a veteran finance executive who assumed sole control of Disney's film business 2 years ago. He's now focused on re-energizing the movie slate after an uneven few years for Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm. Disney employees, to their credit, can be as tight-lipped as the Secret Service. Iger and the executives in contention to replace him did not comment for this story, but a spokesman sent a statement which read in part, "The Disney board is engaged in a robust and thorough succession planning process to identify Disney's next CEO, and there are currently no designated frontrunners among the very strong candidates being considered, despite any uninformed speculation to the contrary." Interviews with more than 40 sources, both inside Disney and out, paint a picture of a beloved brand that has a chance to set Hollywood's course for years to come, if it can just settle on the right captain. On November 20, 2022, Walden stopped by the American Music Awards, which ABC was broadcasting from downtown L.A., then hurried to Dodger Stadium for Elton John's farewell tour, which Disney Plus live-streamed. As if that weren't enough excitement for one evening, an email hit every Disney inbox that night. Iger was coming back. When staffers got the announcement, some were momentarily confused. "We thought we'd clicked on an old email," recalls an executive, and then they were elated. Less than 3 years earlier, Iger had handed the CEO reins to Chapek, a Disney veteran who had shepherded the theme park and consumer products businesses to new heights. Now Chapek was out, and Iger, who'd been sporting a salt-and-pepper retirement beard and boasting about his carefree new life, was returning for a second stint leading the company. The years that Chapek ran the company were rough on morale. Yes, the pandemic was a nightmare that decimated theme parks and movie theaters overnight. But Chapek, a hard-nosed number cruncher from Indiana, made some profound PR gaffes, like the poor handling of a lawsuit brought by Scarlett Johansson over the streaming release of Black Widow, and his initially out-of-touch response to Florida's Don't Say Gay bill, which eroded trust with Disney's progressive employee base. Chapek changed course on the latter. When Iger returned, Disney's stock surged. The man who'd overseen one of the most prosperous periods in Disney history was once again in charge of Mickey, Buzz Lightyear, Iron Man, and Han Solo. "We were all relieved," an executive says. Walden had a particularly good reason to celebrate. Under Chapek, creative executives have been stripped of financial decision-making authority. Iger restored it. He also handed significantly more power over streaming to Walden, film chief Bergman, and E-SPAN's Pitaro. For Hollywood, it seemed like a sign that they were being set up as potential successors. It had been a remarkable rise for Walden, whom Iger tapped to come aboard Disney after acquiring most of Fox in 2019. She now oversees a broad portfolio that includes ABC, FX, Freeform, and the Disney Channel, which she is managing as the traditional TV business declines. The Bear has been a surprise awards juggernaut. Abbott Elementary has set records for ABC and brought broadcast TV back into the conversation. Walden is a highly visible force in Hollywood. Now she needs to produce hits for Disney Plus while reining in cost. Walden started at Fox as a publicist in the 1990s. When she moved into programming, she demonstrated an uncanny understanding of the zeitgeist. Modern Family, 24, Glee, she had a hand in making them all hits. About a decade ago, she and her partner running Fox had dinner with Dan Fogelman, a screenwriter on Disney kids' classics Cars and Tangled, during a fallow period in his career. Fogelman recalls her saying, "I'm ready to make a bet on you. I want to give you the environment where you're nurtured and protected and where the right decisions are made to support you." Not long after, he turned in a script for a family drama called This Is Us. It became the number one new show on TV in the 18 to 49 demographic and ran for 6 seasons. "She just completely held up her end of the bargain," says Fogelman. "She really is part guru, part decision maker. This business needs more decision makers who have firm points of view and are not afraid to state them." People who worked for Walden at Fox say she could be a challenging boss, though it should be noted that the company encouraged scrappy entrepreneurial hustle and that women leaders in Hollywood are often subjected to more scrutiny than their male counterparts. "She had a spidey sense for everybody's vulnerabilities and went right at them," says a former employee. "If you were doing a great job, sometimes she would praise you, but oftentimes she would make you feel terrible to keep you off balance and to make you work even harder." Some say Walden's edges have softened at Disney. Kelly Ripa says it was Walden's idea to make Ripa's husband, Mark Consuelos, her co-host on Live, adding that it was the first smooth transition that I've experienced in 20-plus years. Grey's Anatomy icon Ellen Pompeo credits Walden with helping keep her at Disney. "Dana was a huge part of me continuing on in this role," she says. "She's a strong leader who values talent relationships and has found ways to keep me at Disney, to let me grow and feel creative." Many people would follow Walden to the ends of the earth. "There's something very charismatic about her," says the former employee. "You felt like you were working for somebody who was really smart, almost clairvoyant." Many of Walden's closest friends are people who used to work for her, or still do. Ryan Murphy met her in the early 2000s, and with her support went on to make Glee for Fox. She is now the godmother of his 3 sons, and when one of them was diagnosed with cancer as a baby, she helped him get into the best hospital for treatment. During those panicky early days of COVID, when Fogelman thought his newborn son might have been infected, Walden worked the phones to get advice from doctors. "Dana is the person everyone in town calls in the event of an emergency," says Murphy. "Disney has never been led by a woman. Even the source close to Disney, who points out that Walden doesn't have as much financial experience as some of the other candidates, says, from an entertainment and creative perspective, Dana would be a fantastic choice, and an historic choice. Last July, Disney held a premiere for its Haunted Mansion movie at Disneyland in Anaheim, California. SAG-AFTRA members had just gone on strike, so none of the stars were on hand to walk the red carpet. Mickey, Minnie, and Cruella De Vil posed for photos with fans instead. Bergman, who runs the film side of the entertainment business, was having a bumpy summer. Barbie and Oppenheimer became a two-headed phenomenon for Warner Brothers and Universal, but Disney's attempt at a blockbuster, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny failed to meet expectations. Haunted Mansion fared poorly. Even The Little Mermaid underperformed in theaters, forcing Disney to contend with racist critiques about casting black actor Halle Bailey as Ariel. Disney is a many-tentacled enterprise, but its success begins and ends with the film studios. That's where characters are born, and if Destiny smiles, become plush toys or theme park rides. Bergman has been at the studio for 23 years. Until longtime film executive Alan Horn retired in 2021, though, he always reported to or worked closely with an executive with deep creative experience. Bergman came from the world of finance, which is certainly an asset. If you threw up a spreadsheet, he'd absorb it in 30 seconds and send questions back at you, so you better be tight on the numbers, says an executive who worked with him. Bergman is often considered a more business-oriented executive, but Horn says he spent a lot of his career learning the creative side of running a film studio. During my 10 years, I invited him to every single script meeting, every cut of a movie, every interaction I had with creative leaders, and he came to every single one, he says. I haven't seen his SATs or anything, but this guy's a very smart guy, so I know that he listened. Why did he listen? Because it was important to him to learn the creative side. When Horn let his friend Iger know that he planned to retire, he told him that Bergman could do the job. Bergman, who owns a Napa Valley vineyard with his family, is said to be fond of classic Disney IP, and sources say his love for the brand runs deep. He presides over a large portfolio, including animated films, blockbusters, and smaller prestige movies like Poor Things. James Cameron didn't know Bergman well when he began making the Avatar sequel for Disney, but says he grew comfortable with him after test screenings suggested there was still work to be done. We emerged out of that process with a greater sense of respect for each other than I've personally ever felt before working with a studio. It was very contentious with 20th Century Fox and Paramount on Titanic. It was contentious with 20th Century Fox on the first Avatar film. And I didn't experience any of that with Alan. Picking a new CEO is not a personality contest, at least not entirely. But for what it's worth, multiple sources say that Bergman is old school and can be prickly and impatient. He's not considered the likeliest candidate for the CEO job, but fixing a film studio doesn't leave much time to audition for a new gig. Bergman, of course, isn't the only movie executive contending with fallout from the pandemic. If Disney's upcoming slate, Inside Out 2, Deadpool and Wolverine, and Moana 2, scores at the box office, Iger and the board will certainly notice. As the historic dual strikes stretched into fall last year, things looked dire for every traditional Hollywood studio. Iger invested in an unaffected part of the company, theme parks. In September, a year ago, Disney announced that it would double its spending from nearly $30 billion to roughly $60 billion to expand the parks and cruise lines. Disneyland Resort, for one, could get new shops, restaurants, and rides based on Avatar, Frozen, and Zootopia. The investment was a clear vote of confidence in DeMauro, who has spent much of his 26-year Disney career working his way through the parks business. Polished and professional, he once moved to Hong Kong Disneyland for 4 years to rebuild relationships with partners in the region after a rocky launch. He also oversaw Disneyland's Star Wars, Galaxy's Edge, and spearheaded the park's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Multiple people tell us that no problem is too small for him, even as his responsibilities have grown. Years ago, when DeMauro was still an up-and-coming executive, he gave Avatar producer John Landau a tour of Disney World as they were preparing to bring Pandora to the park. "We are walking around the park for the first time, and I see him stop behind us," Landau says. He uses a little cane he has, and he picks up some garbage that was on the ground, puts it in the trash bin, and continues on. I thought that was so great. That's the attention to detail that Josh puts into something. Tomorrow seems private about his family life. Of Iger's top lieutenants, he's the only one with a prominent public Instagram account. He has 151,000 followers, but it's entirely devoted to his job. An executive who has worked with him says he's more image conscious than he lets on. That effortless cool, there's effort behind it. Damaro lives with his wife in Orange County, has college-age children, and quietly travels in rarefied circles. During the pandemic, he and Delta CEO Ed Bastian worked to revitalize the hospitality industry as members of the U.S. Travel Association. Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, who counts Disney as one of his company's key clients, considers Damaro a friend and shares his love of Foo Fighters. "He's somebody who bleeds Disney," Benioff says. "His heart and soul is very much wrapped up inside the Magic Kingdom." Pitaro is a former college football player and an avid Yankees fan. He led Yahoo's media division before his friend Sheryl Sandberg. Then a Disney board member introduced him to Iger. In 2017, while Pitaro was running Disney Consumer Products and Interactive Media, E-SPAN's charismatic leader John Skipper abruptly resigned, later revealing that he had a cocaine problem and was the target of an extortion attempt. Pitaro's love of sports helped him land the job. You can often find Pitaro eating among his employees in the cafeteria at E-SPAN's sprawling Bristol, Connecticut headquarters. "He's not somebody who has a giant ego," says Michael Levine, co-head of CAA Sports, who was fraternity brothers with him at Cornell. The Disney board has outlined a thorough process this time around. As the company said in its statement to Vanity Fair, it is a top priority of the board to not only name a successor, but to position them for long-term success. And with more than 2.5 years remaining under Bob Iger's term as CEO, the succession planning committee is proceeding thoughtfully and carefully. The internal candidates are said to be working with executive coaches, learning about parts of the business they don't oversee, and receiving guidance directly from Iger. The public nature of the search means the pressure is on. A quick, small win in the optics department for aspirants might mean sitting close to Iger at events, or even dressing more like him. "Dana, like Bob, is a real star," says Murphy. "When they walk into a room, the energy changes." Damaro has the Iger vibe, too. As Benioff of Salesforce puts it, "You can't look at Josh without looking at Bob." Speaking of which, not everybody wants Iger to leave at all. "I don't know what the rush is to make a change," says analyst Rife Ehrlich, to which one of Hollywood's top agents adds, "Look, the effing president's like 800 years old, and he's just starting to wobble. Bob's unbelievable. He's at the top of all of his powers." But when he wrote his 2019 book, The Ride of a Lifetime, Iger seemed to have made peace with saying goodbye. "We all want to believe we're irreplaceable," he wrote. "The trick is to be self-aware enough that you don't cling to the notion that you are the only person who can do this job." Now he and Disney just have to prove it. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.